So welcome everybody to this morning's Dhamma talk. This is the first morning talk of the November 2009 meditation retreat. And it's nice to get an understanding of what we're doing here, what meditation is, how it works, and taking it from a perspective which I was indicating last night about the perspective of stillness. Why stillness? How stillness? As many of you have heard me teach countless times, that the word for meditation in Pali is samadhi, and for maybe about 150 years that has been translated as concentration. And that came from Professor T.W. Rice-Davids, who was a district officer in Sri Lanka, an Englishman who went over to Sri Lanka, admired the culture, learnt Pali in his spare time, and when he returned to UK, he was the first person who started translating some of the Pali works into English. And he chose many words, some of which were brilliant translations, such as the word mindfulness for sati, as an inspired choice of words. But when he translated a word for samadhi as concentration, it didn't really sort of hit the point, because as many of you know, that concentration is what you force the mind to do at school. You probably remember your teacher at high school or primary school saying, "Concentrate, Eileen. Concentrate, Chi Wei." And it was a forceful activity to try and push the mind onto the task. And that's not really what we mean by samadhi. And also, because this is a samadhi camp, if samadhi meant concentration, then this becomes Jhana Grove concentration camp. And sometimes some retreats are very much like that. You can't leave. And if you get up late, you're hauled into the hall. It's sometimes like a... Well, let's not go further into that. But for many years, I was never really sort of happy with that word, concentration. And looking for new words, I think for many years I've tried to use the word sustained attention. But these days, I much prefer the word stillness for the word samadhi. So this is not a concentration camp, this is a stillness camp. And just that whole word, stillness, gives a totally different emphasis to what we're doing here, what the goal is, and it makes it quite clear what we should do to achieve that goal. Because we have physical stillness and we have mental stillness. And you all know what physical stillness is. Stopping running around. Stopping getting up, sitting down, going over here, going over there. It's the opposite of the restlessness of the body. And you know that's what you have to do in the world. Running around, going places, and you get somewhere, there's always another place to go to, or you're usually late. There's so many things you have to do which stops your body being still. But here, there's very little to do. The reason why we have these retreats organized to restrict the amount of business you have to do to the absolute minimum. So you don't have much to do at all, which means your body can have a chance to become still. Even when people sleep at night, if ever you took a video of them sleeping, they'd be tossing and turning, always moving in their bed. Even when you're sleeping, the body can't be still. Because it can't be still, the body wears out very quickly. Just like if you gun a car, as they say, always driving it, stopping it very suddenly. If you use your vehicle with aggression, with no gentleness, it will not last that long. It's the same with your body. If you can only learn how to move your body more gently and find more moments of stillness, your body will last much longer, in greater health, energy and clarity. So So, number one, see if you can feel the stillness of the body. And it's interesting to understand stillness of the body. How the heck can we get our body to be still? I know there are these soldiers, like in the front of Buckingham Palace, who stand there, not moving, while all these tourists take photographs of them, or deliberately try to provoke them so they're not still. They're so well trained to be able to stay absolutely still on guard, not really on guard for the Queen, but just as a symbol for the tourists to photograph. They can stand there for a long time without moving. But they can't do that by force. The only way you can do that is by letting go of the body. Because as soon as you are connected to your body, you're also connected to all the irritations, aches and pains of this body. And this body is never comfortable enough for you. Of all the things which are demanding of your attention in the world, the body is probably the main demander of your attention. Someone pointed this out to me, no, maybe 30 years ago, when they said, just look at people, even when they're meditating, and how many people are really still, and how many people are just moving this, scratching that, even just opening their eyes, blinking their eyes. It's all activity of the body. And you'll find your body very rarely leaves you alone. When it demands something, you can refuse it, and just be quite strong, but you can't maintain that for too long. But there is another way to be still with the body, and I think you've probably seen people doing that in meditation retreats, or you may have experienced it yourself, and that is when your body disappears. In meditation, when you take your attention away from the body, you find the body becomes perfectly still, and can sit there for hours and hours and hours without needing to scratch, without needing to do anything at all. It's the most comfortable time for your body in meditation when you're attending to your mind and totally unaware of all these feelings and sensations in your body. This gives you an idea of what stillness means. So if you let go of your body, and the body becomes still, what do you think happens when you let go of your mind? And then your mind becomes still and comfortable and at ease. Because even your mind is always demanding. It's always irritated. That's the irritation of the mind. It's called thought. It's called anger, ill will, craving. That's an irritation of your mind. And as long as we are connected to that, you'll find that there's no peace at all, no stillness. So if our goal is stillness, we get a good idea of what to do to achieve that stillness. To restrain that thing which always wants to do something, move something, change something. What I've called the fault-finding mind. That fault-finding mind has been well established inside of each one of you for so many years. And there's no end of faults to see in this world. Even in the most perfect place, you can find faults. Such as this retreat center. We just put a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of care into this retreat center. We really bent over backwards trying to make this as perfect as possible. But I'm sure that by now you've already seen so many faults in this retreat center. I remember just the IMS, International Meditation Society in Massachusetts. They got a few very wealthy people to buy this old thing, Catholic seminary, and to convert it into a retreat center. And they really, really put a lot of care, thought and effort into making this really comfortable. So people could do meditation retreats at ease. And having spent a lot of money, and with all the old meditators racking their brains, how can we improve this? They thought, I don't think we can make it any better. But one of them suggested, well, we may not know how to make it better, but maybe the meditators can have an idea. So they decided to put in a suggestions box. With an hour or two, that suggestion box was overflowing with complaints. And they discovered just the more perfect you make it, the more complaints there are. You know the psychology of that? Because when it's almost perfect, you know, you think, come on guys, just a little bit more and it'll be really perfect. And that really motivates you to complain. If it was totally hopeless, you know, totally a mess, it's not worth complaining. The suggestion box will be empty. There's an interesting part of the psychology of the mind, just like you. Your meditation might be going so well, but it's almost there, but not quite, and that's when you complain the most. So be careful of that psychology. But that fault-finding mind means we can never find any peace at all. The bed is not soft enough. The temperature is not right enough. It's the breakfast is not warm enough. The marmalade is not sweet enough. The tea is not hot enough. That fault-finding mind can find fault anywhere, which means you have more business to do. Because every time you find a fault, it means you've got something to do. Something to think about, something to plan so you can fix later on, or get someone else to fix it for you. Which means you've lost your stillness. The only way to find stillness, and this is a very important part of meditation technique, the only way to find stillness is by letting go of the fault-finding mind and in its place putting contentment and gratitude. This is good enough. Sometimes people think that contentment, gratitude, this is good enough, will mean you get lazy and you won't make any progress in meditation. Surely you have to strive, set goals and work hard to get into deep meditation. Many of you have tried that. I've tried that. I know how far it can take you. But eventually you come across a barrier. As I mentioned last night, all striving strengthens the sense of self. Strengthens the ego. And when you strive and the ego gets strengthened, you can't let go. The ego just wants to control ever more and more and more. So why striving is a path which does not end in nirvana, just ends in rebirth, more and more life. However, contentment, what does it mean to be content? It means you're happy to be here. You can see this moment and it's good enough for you. Sure, if you can find fault with it, but you can find fault with anything. But this is good enough. Which means you don't have to do any business with this moment. You can accept it, embrace it for what it is. You can see that contentment also means what I've called unconditional mindfulness. Again, adding these extra words to this powerful term of mindfulness, unconditional mindfulness. What do you mean by unconditional mindfulness? You're aware of this moment without judging it, without rejecting it, without finding fault with it. You're just looking at this moment with no conditions, accepting it for what it is, respecting it for what it is, embracing it for what it is, not finding any fault. Can you find, just like, you know, the bricks in this hall, just like the trees in the forest, just like the weather in the sky, so your mind. It just goes according to nature. And if you think, well, I want to make it perfect. Now what is a perfect forest? What is a perfect sky? What are perfect bricks? I don't know, I've never found anything which is perfectly in line, perfectly straight. I've never found a sky which is perfectly blue. There's always things which people look upon as imperfections, but I look upon that as just life. The same as your mind. What's your perfect mind? Your mind is just the way it is. All those things which you're trying to get rid of, trying to change, you just make more problems that way. So instead, if you want stillness, if you want to understand how to meditate, we develop this beautiful contentment in this moment. This is good enough for me. I'm just happy to be here. Sometimes for those who come from traditional Buddhist backgrounds, sometimes I encourage you just to contemplate that you're just sitting meditation. You're sitting cross-legged in a Buddhist meditation center. That's enough that you've got this far. Everything else, as they say, is gravy, is extra. But you've done enough just to come here and sit down. When you have that degree of contentment, the very fact I'm meditating here, whatever happens, doesn't matter. I'm just here. Hooray, good, enough. Then when you don't demand anything, when you don't expect anything, when you don't want anything, you're just happy to be here. That is called contentment. You're starting the path of stillness. Because what happens when you don't move is you get more and more still. In the same way that old simile, I'm not going to do it here because you've all seen this 20, 30 times. When I hold up a glass and I say, is this glass still? Or rather the water in the glass, is it still? And you say, no, it's not still. So I try even harder to hold that water perfectly still, and I can never manage it. Because every time you hold something, you disturb it. Even for those of you who know some science, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. All comes from if you observe something, you disturb it. If you measure it, you agitate it. And that's the problem of the mind. Just by being, we disturb the universe. And now we're trying to become still. Which means, if you follow my logic, you have to disappear. And remember Heisenberg, because you're disturbing things, you can never know the true reality of things. When you look, you change things. So if you want to be still, you have to somehow or other calm the mind. So it hardly is at all. So it's not even looking. It disappears. And when the observer totally disappears, only then, according to Heisenberg, is there stillness and truth. But that's another little angle. But when you are still, just like that water, when you're not disturbing it, you put it down and you don't hold it. Right, let's do this simply. This water, no, can't we do it? Here we go. This is a very good simile. I'm going to do it again here. See this? A bit more water. You can't hold water still, can you? No way. It's always going to be moving. If I put it down, then it becomes still. And this is the trick of meditation. Contentment means you're not interfering, not picking up things, you're not doing things. Now, if you follow the path of stillness, it's a great error which many people make. They put their mind down, it starts to become still. And what happens next? Is it still yet? That's why I had to do this, because that's an important simile. You start become still, meditation starts to happen, and then you go up and pick it up and disturb it again. So stillness is an art which takes a lot of practice to be able to leave things alone and to continue to leave things alone. And because you're not interfering, you are taking away the cause for unstillness. It is interfering which stops the mind becoming still. And that particular simile is important for the glass of water, because when you first put the mind down, it is not still. You have to let go and be patient. Let go and be patient. For wait for things to slow down and become still. Which is why in the first few days you need patience. Patience is to allow the body to adjust itself to the environment here. When you're not asked to do so much, you don't have to rush around so much. It takes a while for your body to reaccustom itself to the routine of a retreat, which is very slow and easy. And it takes a while for your mind to accustom itself to not have to do things, not have to think, not have to perform, not have to answer questions, not have to live up to any person's expectations. Certainly you don't have to live up to my expectations. I've got no expectations about you. I've given up hope about you a long time ago. No expectations whatsoever. So you don't have to live up to my expectations. I say in every retreat, I'm not going to give you a report card. I'm not going to publish it. A league table of meditators just to embarrass those lazy people. Actually, the lazy people usually come at the top of the report card. It's those control freaks come down the bottom. So, to learn how to let go and to not interfere. And I tell you what happens. And telling you what happens gives you an indication of just the beauty of this part of meditation. It's how I meditate. These days I don't usually watch the breath. I just sit there and I just watch my mind and make sure it doesn't do anything. My job is just like the job of a bouncer at a nightclub. I just got to make sure this terrible thing called doing and controlling and interfering doesn't sneak into my mind. Try to sit there, close the eyes, and just do nothing. See what happens. Or rather, see what is happening with unconditional awareness of this moment. Now, the thing happens is because you're not doing anything, you become still, just like that glass of water. But there's more to stillness than just nothing moving. Because when stillness really establishes itself, things disappear. It's an important understanding of the path of meditation. Understanding from stillness, you get things fading away and disappearing. From samadhi, we get viraga. And from viraga, nirodha. This is classic sequence in Pali. From samadhi, stillness, things fade away. And from them fading away, they eventually totally disappear. What do you mean by that? Close your eyes and you'll see blackness. When you first close your eyes, you can see blackness on the inside of your eyelids. But does that move? Does that change? It remains as it is for second after second. And it's the nature of your brain, of your sensory apparatus. When nothing is changing, in other words, when it's still, it disappears. So you're watching blackness, and after a while, you can't see even blackness anymore. You can't see. Sight is turned off, because there's no change to stimulate it. It is why when I was a lay person, I'd try and go to any retreat which I could possibly find, because it's so rare to find, you know, temples, monasteries, any place. So when 1973, when I was staying in the town of Durham, there was a Zen monastery in a place called Throstle Hole, many, many years ago. So I went on a retreat for the weekend. You know, and I trained in more like Theravada meditation, but this was Zen meditation. So we were told to face the wall with our eyes open and just meditate with your eyes open facing the wall. And it was strange at first, but after a while, when the mind became very still, you weren't moving, the wall disappeared. And that was really weird, but that's actually what's supposed to happen. because it was a blank wall and there was nothing going on there, after 45, 50 minutes, you had the experience of the wall vanishing. It was nothing weird or strange, it was just the nature of the sense of sight. If nothing is changing, the sense turns off. From stillness, things fade away. So in meditation, you can face a wall, or even better, just face the wall that is in the inside of your eyelids. Close your eyes, it's much better. And after a while, the sense of sight disappears. And this sense of seeing can be so disturbing. So I like to close my eyes when I'm meditating, because otherwise I open my eyes and someone is nodding, somebody is scratching, somebody is looking around, waiting for the thing to finish. You know, being a teacher, you know, sometimes it's disturbing watching all your disciples you've been teaching for so many years. So I prefer my eyes closed and just forget about you guys. And it does disappear. So when you're not looking at things, the whole area of the mind is free for other things. This great big business of seeing and working out what you're seeing is totally taken away. You have this huge amount of freedom. Sure, it's strange that you've got nothing to do, but after a while, you love doing nothing. And the great freedom and rest of that such stillness. So the sense of our sight through stillness fades away and disappears. You've got one less sense base to occupy your mind. And of course, all that energy which will be wasted in seeing and figuring out what you're seeing is freed. You get more energy for your mindfulness. You should notice that when you do close your eyes at the beginning of a meditation, you're not very aware of your body, or even of sounds. However, after a few seconds, energy is not flowing into the sense of sight, and all that energy is now free to go into things like feeling sensations, hearing. So which is why that you feel your body much more sensitively with your eyes closed, why you can hear more precisely with your eyes closed. Many people at a concert will close their eyes to be able to enjoy the music more fully, because more energy can now go into the sense of hearing. So when you close your eyes, the sense of sight fades away. The sense of hearing is why we really try on retreats to get up quietly, not to bang any doors, not to change the quietness in the room. And as far as the noble silence is concerned, just to reinforce it, there's a beautiful saying, if you can't improve upon the silence, don't speak. If you can't improve upon the silence, don't speak. And it's very hard to improve upon silence. You have to be able to say something very profound to do better than silence. I don't think you're up to it, so shut up. So when you're silent, you're respecting that silence. And you're giving that gift of silence to all the people in the meditation retreat. Which means that because sounds aren't changing, except maybe the sound of a motorbike on the road ahead, they're so far away that after a while, the non-changing of sound means that the sense of sight, sense of hearing, fades away and vanishes. You'll find during this retreat there are many meditations that you don't know when it happens, but you can't hear anything. People behind you get up and go, you don't hear a thing. Even at some times, you know, that I might ring the bell for lunch or for breakfast, you won't hear it. That is a sign that the sense of sound has disappeared. Another difficult sense has been put aside to make you free. Sometimes I've compared it to, you know, being at work, and you have 5 different phones, one on the desk, a landline, and 4 mobile phones. I've seen people these days, I haven't got a mobile phone myself, but sometimes people have 2 or 3 mobiles. You know, one is for their wife, one is for their kids, one is for their business, and the other one is for their mistress. So they know who it is. No, that was his wife, which is me. But anyhow, you've got so many phones you have to answer. And this is like the person with the 5 telephones. They're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching. Always competing, always calling you up. You know, there's something to look at. Can you see that over there? There's something to listen to. There's something to feel. There's something to smell or to taste. Now imagine you're at work with these telephones going off all day, one after the other. Many times they call at the same time. You can imagine how stressful that would be. That's what life is like. Having all these different senses calling at you at the same time. Listen to me, see me, smell me, taste me, touch me, says the world. They're all competing for your mental attention. So in the silence, there's no competing anymore. You're free just to be with your mind, rather than being called by sound. Smells and tastes are the 2 easiest senses to let go of. It's very easy for the nose to turn off. You're not smelling anything. Smelling nothing. You're just not smelling anymore. Tasting, because the taste of saliva is always the same, saliva's got a taste. But because it's always there, you can't notice anything. So the sense of taste turns off. So all you've got left is the sense of physical touch. Actually, that's one of the hardest. Sound is also hard to turn off. A lot of times with meditation, those are the 2 big problem senses. Sight is easy to close the eyes. Taste and smell, very easy. It's one of the reasons why in many meditation retreats, they would light incense. They light incense to mask body odor and people who pass wind, so that the sense of smell is always common, is always unchanging. So that you can let go of all sense of odor and smell. So you're left with 2 senses, of hearing and physical touch. And hearing, we just try and keep things reasonably quiet. Physical touch, we try and keep the body still. Doesn't matter what posture you put it in, as long as it's comfortable enough to keep still. Which is why you don't have to sit on the floor. Those chairs around this room, we purchase these specially designed for meditation with lumbar support. Those are chairs with the armrests are for people who have trouble with sloth and torpor, so you don't fall off the chair. We did suggest having seat belts for people with extreme sloth and torpor. But they're designed for your comfort in meditating. So we did that on purpose, because we know that sometimes if you sit on the floor, sometimes it's your body hurts so much you can't let go of the physical feelings. And there are always pain and aches, and they're always disturbing you, so the sense of touch can't disappear. So you can't be still. So please get your body as comfortable as you possibly can, so it can disappear. For those of you whose body is aching and very stiff because of old age or injury, you always ask, can I meditate laying down? Of course you can, that's one of the four postures. But if you do lay down meditating, don't lay down in the same posture with which you go to sleep. If you go to sleep on your right side, don't meditate on the right side. Meditate on the back, front, anywhere. Because if you meditate in the same position which you start to go to sleep in, your mind will get confused. She wants me to go to sleep because she always puts me in this position when I go to sleep. So your mind will get confused and you will go to sleep. However, if you're in a different posture, I always go to sleep on my right side. So if I want to do some meditation, I'll just lie on my back, because I never go to sleep on my back. So I can lie down on my back and my brain knows this is not sleeping posture. So I can be clear. And number two, even if you do use a different posture when you are doing lying down meditation, don't do lying down meditation on top of your bed. Because of course you'll fall asleep. Just do it on the floor. Get some cushions or a mat or something on the floor, because it's not on the bed. Because again, the psychology says on the bed means sleep. So you might start, say, on your back, and in a few seconds, not knowing it, you'll be on your side and then fast asleep. So you can have a nice comfortable position, so stretched out, doing lying down meditation in a different posture. And all that means is your body is not disturbing you, which means that you can allow the sensations in the body to disappear. So whatever posture you use, make sure it's as comfortable as you can possibly get it. Of course, but once the posture is comfortable, you notice that parts of it disappear, stage by stage. Usually, people tell me this, and their hands usually disappear first of all. You can't feel your hands. You ask, where's my hands? You can't know them. It's the sense of touch in that area has disappeared. Maybe you can't feel your legs, can't feel your head, can't feel your body. Just the whole sense of touch has disappeared. Now when I do letting go meditation, this is what happens. Just in the moment, just not thinking, and these things disappear. Sight disappears, smell, taste disappears very quickly. I don't give a damn about sound, it disappears. Body disappears. You know what happens next? When you're sitting absolutely still, what part of your body is still moving? Your breath. Your heart's moving as well. But the coarsest movement left when you're sitting as still as you possibly can is your breathing. Which is why when I let go, just in the present moment, being silent, all these things disappear, leaving the breath as the most prominent perception. This is why the Buddha taught breath meditation. It happens naturally. Even if you don't choose to watch the breath, when everything else calms down, that's the most prominent moving thing. The only thing the brain can really focus on, because nothing else is moving. Which is why when you let go in this way, you don't need to watch the breath through force. Through letting go, the breath comes to you and manifests, because everything else is quiet, it's the only thing left. And so your job is to be able to calm this last movement of the body, which you can perceive, the breathing. And as it calms down more and more, it's strange, but the in-breath and the out-breath tend to coalesce. You can't see the difference between an in-breath and an out-breath. When you're first breathing, the in-breath and the out-breath have a totally different feel to them. So much so you can distinguish them. You don't distinguish them because the out-breath is what happens after the in-breath and the in-breath is what happens after the out-breath. It has a different sensation to it. You can identify that. But as you calm down more and more and more, the in-breath and the out-breath start to kind of look the same. And even the beginning, middle and end of each breath, the sensation starts to become the same. This is the nature of that breath. It becomes even. Just breathing. You can hardly tell in or out, beginning, middle or end. This is nature. You're just breathing, that's all. And that particular part of the sensation which tells you it's an in or an out breath, beginning, middle or end, that has disappeared. It's gone. That's an important stage in the breath meditation. The stage which I very rarely talk about, but it's a true stage, where you cannot perceive the quality of in, out, beginning, middle or end. For those of you who haven't heard this simile, this is in Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. He gave the simile of a carpenter sawing a piece of wood. He says when the carpenter first starts sawing a piece of wood, he can see most of the plank of wood, and he can also see the end of the saw, the middle of the saw, and the handle of the saw. But as he focuses in, he can only see two or three saw teeth at the place where the cut is being made. You can only see maybe a centimeter of wood, again, at the place where the saw is touching the wood. He's focused in. Because you can only see two or three saw teeth, there's no way of knowing whether that's the beginning, middle or end of the blade. He's got no reference points to know that. In the same way, when you really focus in on the breath, you've got no reference points to know it's beginning, middle or end. Got no reference points to know it's in or out breath. All the things, the information which would have told you it's beginning, middle or end, in or out, have been taken away. In the same way that all the reference points, you know, which tells that carpenter where that particular two or three saw teeth are located in the whole length of the saw blade, has been taken away. So you just know, I'm breathing. And the sensation becomes even. Just breathing. You can hardly notice any change in the sensation from moment to moment to moment. Of course, you know what happens next. Because the breath is now still, I don't say you're not breathing, but the stillness, the evenness of the in and out breath is such that it disappears. You can't notice it anymore. The breath has vanished. And with that breath vanishing, so does your whole body. It's the last stage by which the body, especially the sense of touch, vanishes. Through stillness, we get fading away. From fading away, cessation. It's the cessation of your five senses. They're stilling, they're calming. Not through force, not through subjugation. Can't be done that way. But this beautiful method of meditation. So you sit here and your body's gone. You can't see, not even blackness. You can't hear. Smell, taste, and physical touch is gone. For some people that's scary. For those people who know what it's like, it's bliss. The body, according to Buddhism, sucks. It's dukkha. Instead of calling it dukkha, sucks. Use modern language. It's always asking, demanding for something. Take me to the toilet. Give me something to eat. Give me something to drink. I need to wee. I need to rest. I need to scratch. I need to do something. My body is totally demanding. And it's very rare you can find any peace with this body. But when it disappears, it's like you've been carrying this burden, this backpack filled with five rocks, heavy rocks. Been carrying them as long as you can remember. All day and all night, 365 days of the year. And now you've found a way to put that rucksack down. Oh, feels so nice. And that's what happens when you let go of the five senses and with it the body. You feel so free. As I mentioned to several people, that feeling of letting go of the body has its counterpart to your death. That's why for many people it's scary when you let go of your body. Because it is exactly the same which happens to you when you die. You let go of the body and your five senses turn off. So people in death experience of floating out of the body, going to the light and having a beautiful, wonderful time. Well, one of the videos which somebody showed us recently, there's a story of this one lady who had a near-death experience because of some operation. And floating out of her body, going to the light, she had the most wonderful, blissful time of her life. She never experienced so much peace and happiness and freedom. She didn't want to come back. And then she met some sort of uncle who told her, you know, you have to come back. She said, don't want to go. You have to. Nope, I'm not going. And in this near-death experience, she had an argument. And this sort of uncle who was guiding her literally threw her back into her body. And she was pissed off to the max, having to get back in her body. And she said, I'll never forgive that sort of that angel for doing that to me. It's really funny, but what it was really important to say is this is so lovely and peaceful and wonderful being free from your body. And all of you who've got any sickness, especially chronic sickness, you notice how much this body sucks. And this is total torment. And for those of you who haven't got chronic sickness yet, it's coming, believe you me. You get older in sickness. The chronic, most chronic sickness is old age. So it's great to be free of this body. And this is how you do it. So it is bliss, it's peaceful, it's wonderful. And that gives you the first ecstasies of meditation. Just totally feel this body. You can't see, you can't hear, smell, taste, touch. People just call that samatha. Samatha, calming things down till they disappear. And you know they're calmed down because the sign of calming down is things vanish. If you still can feel the body, you can still hear sounds, you haven't calmed down enough yet. You're still sort of moving, interfering with things. The cup isn't still. You've still been holding and interfering. When things do disappear, that is a classic sign you've become calm. You've let go and things have vanished. So when that happens, it's bliss. You've calmed things down. But of course, you will get the great insights from those experiences. In the same way that people who have near-death experiences get the great insights into the death process, and they come back, nearly all of them, never ever afraid of death again. They're not afraid of it because they've tasted, they know what it's like. Five senses disappearing. This is wonderful, this is joyful. What are people so afraid of dying for? They get an insight. And real insights, the ones which matter, are not something which you can write in a book and impress your friends with. It's not something you can discuss over a coffee table to show how much Buddhism you know. Real insights are those which change your life. It's changed the way you experience the world. So a person who knows what it's like for the five senses to disappear, the insight means they're not afraid of dying. They know what's going on. They're totally at peace with it. And in fact, that usually if they have any defilement, it's just, bring it on quickly, please. I can't wait. It would have been impatience for that experience. However, once that mind, that body is still, five senses have disappeared. What's left next? Your sixth sense, the mind. And that's one of the reasons we do this meditation, so we can release the mind from the body. I don't mean floating out of the body. You're not floating anywhere. You're right with your mind, not going anywhere, not perceiving of walls or ceilings or jhana groves or anything. That whole world of space, to do with the five senses is gone. It's actually why those people have near-death experiences, they can still see and hear floating out of the body. The five senses haven't stopped yet. They've just been subdued. It's only when they float away and go towards that light can you say the five senses have stopped. So when your five senses stop, what's left? They have a simile of the Buddha, and that simile is the simile of gold. He said if somebody wants to test out gold, to find out its properties and maybe use it to make an ornament, you have to get pure gold first of all. You might get some ore or nugget from the ground, but it will be full of impurities. It won't be 100% gold. So the goldsmith or the chemist has to heat it, put chemicals in it, whatever, to purify it, to get rid of everything else other than the pure gold. And once you've got all the other trace elements out of that sample, once you're just left with 100% pure gold, then you could test it, find out its properties, and even make it into something beautiful for someone. And that's the Buddha's simile of gold. And he used that for the simile of mind. The piece of gold is like your body and mind. Yeah, it's got gold in it, the mind. It's got all these other impurities, all these five trace elements, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and physical touch. And because they're always intermingled with your mind, you can't really know the mind. No more than a chemist could get some clear indication what gold is when it's got other impurities in it. So once you've got pure mind, only mind, 100% mind, with all the other five senses absent, then you can find out what this mind is. And that is the main task of insight. It is the main philosophical task to find out who I am or what I am. What is this knower? What is this doer? What is will? What is consciousness? And of course, how can you find that out when you've got this consciousness, this mind mixed up with all sorts of other stuff? And I don't make up that simile. That's a simile from the Buddha. I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, the simile of the goldsmith. So we try and find this pure gold, this mind. And once we find this pure mind, this gold, then we can find out all sorts of amazing things about it. How it is the most valuable of metals. How this mind is the forerunner and chief of all things. You're coming up to the emperor. That emperor's simile, which just comes up now, was that imagine there was an emperor, and the emperor was always covered with the five pieces of clothing, with boots which go past his knees, with trousers which overlap his boots and go up past his waist, with a jacket which overlaps his trousers, and it has sleeves which go to his wrists, and then high neck piece which goes to his neck. He's got gloves which overlap the end of his sleeves, and a huge helmet which overlaps the top of his jacket. So all these clothes overlap one another. So there's no part of that emperor's body which you can see. Everything is covered by the five garments. So you cannot know whether that emperor is an African-American by the name of Obama, or a Queenslander by the name of Kevin, or it's a girl, a boy, a gay, big or small. You don't know, you can't see the person. Now that's a simile for your mind, covered with the five senses instead of the five garments. You can't get to your mind to really know it perfectly. So if you really want to find out who that emperor is, it's the most powerful being in the universe, you want to find out who you are, then you've got to take off these five garments. Take off the five senses. So you've just got mind and nothing else. Stay with that long enough and you get to know some amazing things about this mind. all these teachings about not self, not me, not mine, there you can actually see it. You can't sort of imagine it. This is something you have to see through direct personal experience of mind. So what happens when you let go of all these things and the body becomes still? You become happy. The joy of meditation is a direct result of how many burdens you've let go of. Just let go of the body a little bit and you feel free. Let go of the body a lot and you feel really happy, just sitting here having a wonderful time. Let go of the body totally, the five senses disappear and you're having a great time. The best bliss of your life, and that bliss, you see this beautiful light come up in the mind. Just the way that you experience your mind with a beautiful nimitta. I'm taking beautiful, I mean, this is beautiful. The most beautiful thing you've ever seen. Radiant, powerful, beautiful, brilliant. So when those lights really start to establish themselves, it's your mind. Exactly the same which people see when they die, going towards the light. Beautiful, ecstatic, pure love, 100% whatever. Those are experiences that people who have NDEs. Exactly the same as people who have the proper experiences of nimittas when their five senses disappear. And you're right there with your mind. It's the most wonderful way to become enlightened. Through bliss. Through profundity. Through releasing the mind from the body. So you can examine it, investigate, get to know it. And coming out afterwards, you'll be changed. No more will you be so concerned with worldly things. We know these worldly things are just so much sort of packaging which surrounds the beautiful mind. Your mind will become the most important thing. It will become the chief, the forerunner. And all this other stuff which you deal with and worry about in life. Yeah, you have to deal with it, but it's not, will never be so important anymore. You'll be able to let go more, to renounce more. You don't let go and renounce out of negativity. Monks don't stay monks, nuns don't stay nuns because they're fed up with the world. Monks and nuns stay monks and nuns, not out of negativity to the world, out of awe, out of joy to the mind, and that realm when the body disappears. They're pulled there through joy rather than pushed away through aversion. That's what we want you to feel. Just the joy and the bliss and the freedom of the mind. Just to experience that is a marvelous insight. A marvelous ability to be so still that you're free. And these things happen naturally. You don't go and say, right, I'm now going to let go of all my senses. You can't do that. I said many times, I put my hand up, I confess, Ajahn Brahm, I cannot meditate. I can't do it. I have to disappear, and then meditation happens. Ajahn Brahm has to vanish. Once I get out of the way, meditation comes so nice and easy. That's how I meditate and have a wonderful time. If I get in the way, it all goes pear-shaped. So please remember that. Your job is to be still. You don't become still by holding the cup, holding your mind. You need absolute patience, contentment, and wait for things to unfold. Wait. But when you're waiting, I'll just finish off with a subtle point. There are two types of waiting, which I've noticed. I've noticed my mind do this. One is called waiting in the future. Waiting for the talk to finish. Waiting for lunch. Waiting for the nimitta to arise. What the great playwright Beckett said, waiting for Godot. You know, and that can be anything. Jhanas, enlightenment, you know, the beautiful relationship, whatever. Always waiting for something in the future. That's the wrong type of waiting. And be careful. Because some of you might be meditating, I'm letting go, and you're waiting for something to happen. That's called waiting in the future. Waiting in the present. It's not waiting for something to happen. Waiting on what's already happening. Like a waiter looking after his or her customer. Attending to your customer's needs now. Waiting on the moment. Not waiting in the future. So when you learn how to wait on something, which means you're totally consumed by the content of now. You're not expecting anything, you're not wanting anything. Your job is just to be. Be still and attend with unconditional service onto your customer. So when you know the two different types of waiting, the waiting in the future and the waiting on the moment, this moment right now, you know how to wait, what patience is all about. Waiting in the future is not being patient. It's just torturing yourself. Always hoping something might happen. Waiting on the moment is peace, is freedom. You wait on the moment, things have to happen. Just cause and effect. There's no question about it. It's going to happen. Your job is just to be there when it does happen. Just like the story about the postman delivering your check. The postman's going to come during this retreat. He's got a great check for you. Many checks. Jhana 1, Jhana 2, Jhana 3, Jhana 4. Enlightenment 1, 2, 3, 4. All these checks are in the mail. I know it. I've seen them sort of being posted. But you have to be here when the postman calls. If you're thinking about, oh, the holiday I'm going to next week, or you're thinking about, oh, what's my husband doing back in Singapore, then when the postman calls, you're not at home. Sorry, you've missed your jhana. So remember, wait on the moment, not in the future. And then you know what patience is, what stillness is. You find all these things that just happen. All these stages of meditation, they come to you, you don't even need to follow them. And the whole mind opens and opens and opens till the pure mind comes, pure gold. And you start to play around with this amazing thing called the mind. And so much happiness and joy, so many insights, you just wouldn't believe it. So you find out. That's the first talk on stillness, things fading away, and finding pure gold. So any questions or comments on that so far? Very good. If there are any questions which come up during today, in the foyer of this meditation hall, you will find a basket. In that basket, or close by to the basket, you'll find some pieces of paper. Next to the pieces of paper, there'll be some writing equipment. And of course, I think you can connect the dots. The pens are there to write on the paper. And the box is there, the basket is there to put the piece of paper in. So those are for your questions. So any time of the day, you can put that question down. And in this evening, I will attempt to answer those questions. And it is actually much better to put your question down and share it with others rather than just privately ask me. Because that way your question, and all your questions are good questions, there's no such thing as a stupid or a bad question, then your question can be shared with others. And the answer which I give can be of assistance to others. Thereby, your writing of a question, rather than asking it personally, generates far more merit for you, far more good karma, because your question is helping the meditation of 60 others, rather than just yourself. So please remember that. Nevertheless, there are opportunities for interviews. Normally, for the first day of these 9-day retreats, I don't have interviews. They usually start on Sunday morning. But because tomorrow morning, after the talk, I have to go, I'll be back in the early afternoon, I'm going to have the first series of interviews this afternoon, from 3 till 5. In the just by the two offices opposite the dining area, in that passageway where you see the golf buggy, you'll see there a lectern. And on the lectern is the day's interview schedule. And as I said last night, I'm not going to put anybody's names down and just ask people to come. It's up to you to put your name down if you want an interview. And so the first interview is for this afternoon, 3 o'clock till 5 o'clock. If you want an interview, please put your name down. But don't start from the bottom or put your name in the middle. Start from the top and work down. So, in other words, the first person puts their name down is 3 p.m. till 3:10. The next one is 3:10 to 3:20. The next one 3:20 to 3:30. Just one after the other. Because otherwise it gets really difficult for me. When somebody's put their name down from 3 to 3:10, another one from 3:40 to 3:50, another one from 4:10 to 4:20, and another one from 4:50 to 5 o'clock, with all these spaces in between. So, you know, even I can't meditate because I've got to wait for you guys. So remember, just one after the other from top to bottom. So that I know exactly how many people I can just do you all in one go. And the interviews will be held in the space between the two offices. We tried that last time with the Buddhist Fellowship. It means that as a monk, I want you to have the chaperone because it's in an open place. So those will be where those interviews are held. In the space between the two offices opposite the dining room. So is that quite clear? Okay, so you can put your name down. The piece of paper is there already if you want an interview this afternoon. In the meantime, now is another couple of hours before we have our lunch. So it's a wonderful time to wait on the moment, not wait in the future. How many hours? 1 hour and 48 minutes and 30 seconds. So we're not going to think like that. If you're tired, take a rest. Don't worry, if I go to sleep now I'm going to miss lunch. I guarantee you will wake up before lunch. So if you want to rest, take a rest. If you want to do some walking, do some walking. Some sitting, some sitting. Whatever you wish to do, take a cup of tea. Remember that, you know, you work with your body, be a friend with it. Don't treat your body as a slave. Okay, happy meditating.